I think we should kick off with you reading something from it.
Yeah, absolutely. A short reading, not super long. We are constantly being made to serve the needs of two systems, technology and capitalism. Their purposes and goals are almost always prioritized above all others. Their imperatives and logics very often have more influence than any others. These systems could also be called structures. They are structures in the sense that they force social life into specific forms, but also in the sense that we live inside. We are completely entombed by these social constructs. Neither exist outside humans, but both are treated as beyond human. They are products of human values, choices, and actions, but they are also larger-than-life institutions that even the most powerful people claim to have no control over. At the same time, those powerful people deny anybody else the agency to exert control over these systems. In this way, technology and capitalism are more like religions and states. In a relatively short amount of time, just a few hundred years really, these modern systems have altered human society and the natural world at every scale. They are not totalizing in the way that destiny is inescapable or that God is omniscient. Rather, they are totalizing in a way that is more like a toxic miasma, an oppressive cloud, emanating from everywhere, choking and trapping anything caught in its atmospheric existence, which is now essentially everything. Technology and capitalism work in tandem to create mutually reinforcing systems, which we must then work for, within, and against. We cannot understand one without seeing how it is connected to the other. They have fused together into a dual system, technological capitalism. The real complexity of these systems and our complex understandings of them as ideological and material forces is only truly revealed by seeing their parts in action and in dynamic relation with each other. This book shows that action, studies that relation, and demystifies these systems. The two opening paragraphs of the book, and I think it really sets the scene for what I'm trying to do in this book, which is demystify these systems and understand them as that, as two human-created systems that have become fetishized in a way where they seem to exist outside of humanity, but also mutually reinforced through this kind of dual power situation that also reinforces this idea that they are so complex, so massive, that no puny human could possibly understand them, right? And instead, we must simply learn to live with them. And I really wanted to debunk, demystify that idea through a real materialist analysis of these systems as social constructs, as the product of people's choices, even if the people making those choices do not understand the choices that they are making. And so that I think that's where the mission of the book. In the book, I really set up what I mean by a materialist critique and by setting it against its foil of the idealist. Yeah. And because I think that is very much where our thinking, whether pessimistic or enthusiastic, whether critical or captivated, our thinking about technology is very much caught up in an idealist mode, right? And by that, I mean a mode that is kind of like we exist in our mind palace, right? That, like, you know, thoughts precede any change in the world. In fact, thoughts are the prime mover of change in the world, right? Our wishes, our hopes, our desires, these are the things that create the world and create the change in the world. And we see that in all of the discourse and the claims around technology, right? That, like, you know, there's this real claims reality gap that we see. And, you know, it has been here for a long time, but I think it's most apparent right now in AI, where we think about what are the claims being made about a technology. I mean, it wasn't that long ago, only really a month ago, where Sam Altman wrote a blog post talking about how the soft singularity is already here, right? The sparks of artificial general intelligence are here. And in fact, he was claiming that internally at OpenAI, they already have AGI, right? And they were going to release that to the public with the next update, GPT-5, right? You might be shocked to learn that people who have otherwise been completely enthralled by ChatGPT are literally filing petitions against OpenAI to say, this new model sucks, and please give me the old model. Where's the AGI, right? But that's common, right? That's how we understand technology, as a series of marketing claims, as a series of promises, as a series of hopes and desires. And then we are expected to take that on as, that's how these things work. That's how they operate. That's what they do in the world, right? That, to me, is the idealism. And I think of the historian Lee Vinsel, who coined, you know, critihype, right? A kind of skeptical pessimism that is still a form of idealism. For me, though, the materialism has to stand counter to that. It has to actually say, you know, how does the system actually operate? What does it actually do in reality? And how is it the product of political, economic bases and foundations that give rise to these technologies in specific ways and give rise to specific functions, right? It's, in other words, it's shining the interrogative light on the technology, maybe slapping it around a little bit and saying, who do you work for? What do you do, right? Don't give me any bullshit. Tell me for real, right? Like, that is the materialist method, is one of saying, I won't accept what you claim to do, I will only accept what I see you doing in reality, right? And as simple as that sounds, I think when you lay out the materialist method in this way, of like, it does sound rudimentary, but it is, I think, still a pretty radical position to take in a world where everybody is lost in their own mind palace.
And particularly where technology is seen as something that's designed by a small section of very clever men who are paid large sums of money to not create things, paid large sums of money to create things, huge amounts of money moving through this system among a small coterie of people that are supposedly smarter than everybody else, right? So that's the other way in which I think that idealist narrative is very influential in how technology unfolds. But it did occur to me reading this book that the idealist is sort of like the third character. You have the mechanic and the Luddite, and then the idealist is the two. The two are debunking the third. But I wondered if you could talk a little bit about why you called it that, or what's the device that you're using when you're talking about the mechanic and the Luddite.
Mm. And you're right to pick up on that kind of third character, because that third character does come in the last chapter, where I talk about the futurist as the kind of avatar of idealism, right? But the mechanic and the Luddite as these kind of two orienting figures. To me, these are two sides of the materialist coin. These are two kind of role models for what it means to be a materialist. And I think, in short, the mechanic is an understanding of that, the operations of the machine. How do you work? How are you put together? What do you do? What are the real kind of mechanical... And I really use that mechanical metaphor very intentionally, because I think that there is something about digital systems.
As opposed to, say, an engineer, say.
Yeah, well, as opposed to an engineer, for sure. And I think, and I explain in the book the difference between what I see as the mechanic and the engineer, as the engineering as a profession and as a body of knowledge came out of industrial capital. Capital needing a body of mechanical knowledge that it could marshal towards ends of rationalizing labor processes, of optimizing value extraction. The engineer, and David Noble, the historian of technology, in his book America by Design, is a history of engineering. Where does this profession and this body of knowledge come from? And it is a field of knowledge created by and for capital, in the service of capital. The mechanic precedes that and exists outside of it. And I really use this idea of the mechanic very intentionally, because I think there's something about digital technologies that seems so immaterial, that are so complex, right? And are kind of mystified by design. I mean, whether that's mystified in the sense of it's so complex you couldn't possibly understand the inner workings of a software system, or mystified by the technical features of like a machine learning model, which has hidden layers such that even the people creating it really have no idea how it works. They're fundamentally probabilistic, right? But the mechanic, right, I really wanted to pull in to have mechanical knowledge of, you know, the kind of the operations cause these outcomes of the system, really get into the guts of it. And to me, that's the mechanic, right, is having a sense of how the thing works. The Luddite is the kind of normative end of that coin, right? The Luddites in the original, you know, historical formulation were also mechanics, right? It is not an either or, it's a both and. The Luddites as skilled craftspeople, as artisans, as people with a lot of mechanical knowledge. But the way a mechanic becomes a Luddite is not just by understanding how the technology works, but then asking the question of who do you work for? What work do you do in my life, in my community? And also asking that question of should you exist, right? Yeah. And I think that's that critical edge.
And what
that,
can I do to change it, you know?
Yeah, and that's that ruthless criticism in the subtitle of the book.
Or machine breaking.
Exactly, is asking, like, why do you exist and should you exist? And that's the Luddite question. You know, the subtitle of the book is riffing on Marx. You know, the ruthless criticism of everything existing, right? That is what Marx means by materialist analysis. Not taking anything for granted, holding everything up to interrogation, and not shirking from your findings, right? And I think that is what the Luddites really exemplify, is not shirking from your findings. If your findings are that this machine, these noxious machines, as they called them, are, you know, ruinous of our lives, of our communities, and so on, then the finding there is we either have to petition the boss, which they tried, please change this, or please give us a little bit of control over it. That didn't work. We have to try to negotiate with the powers that be. Well, that didn't work. We're going to protest them. Well, that didn't work. And so after exhausting every option at their available to them, they never shirked from the ruthlessly critical findings of their materialist analysis was, well, we're going to have to destroy this. We have to smash it, right? And to me, that politics of refusal is absolutely important. And I think about the really brilliant work by Anna Lauren Hoffman, who's a philosopher and ethicist of technology, who has written about, I think very simply that, like, no is never an option on the table when it comes to technology, right? You never actually have an ability to say, I don't consent to this, or I don't want this, or no. And if no is not an option, then you're not really given a choice, right? What other points in our life do we see as an absence of consent as a legitimate interaction, right? We have words for those kinds of interactions, and they're not nice ones. But with technology, the politics of refusal, the sweeping no off the table, is just that's table stakes, right? Instead, what we are given in replacement is an ethic of consent, or an ethic of acceptance, is what I call it in the book. What can I do to make you say okay to this technology? What can I do to make you feel like, all right, it's trustworthy enough, it's reliable enough, it's safe enough? What can I do to just make you stop complaining? That is, I think that's even the critical horizon for so many, you know, critics of technology, is the putting things on the table to say, just do this, just do this, just do that, but never putting on the table, stop doing anything. You know, I refuse.
There's some global polling which puts Australia, I think together with Finland and New Zealand, like dead last or close to it, on most of the questions about optimism, excitement about AI. And this is often discussed in policy circles as being this huge challenge, because how do we convince people to embrace the possibility? I was like, this is a national asset. You know, we want people to be critical of these systems, because that is that's a foundation for a meaningful engagement, for a form of literacy, for all sorts of things, right? So that's my argument. Doesn't go down well everywhere, but I do make it nonetheless. I would say, like, this discussion, I really enjoy the framing. I think it is very useful for, you know, having discussions about these topics. But I would say the book is also full of very practical examinations of aspects of the tech industry that otherwise I think come across as quite bewildering. Like, why is venture capitalist money so influential in the development of tech? How does it operate? How does it socialize its risks and privatize its gains? Also, like, how does the datification of people operate to turn them into people they aren't, like to strip them of their humanity and their unique dignity? And what does this look like in a systemic form? What is the way in which I liked this concept in particular, the role of landlords, understanding many companies that are, you know, traditionally called platforms or whatever, as being landlords, that is an integral part of capitalism from day dot, right? That functionality of people making money off other people's assets, right? And when you apply a materialist lens to some of the ways in which the tech industry operates, you start to see how much it's oriented away from solving real-world problems for real people and towards extracting value for a certain section of society. But maybe if I can, I'll press you, Jathan, to talk a little bit about that question of datification of people, because I love privacy. I think it's a really important right, like the most important right, because I sort of see this information extraction as being not just immoral, but also taking information for one purpose and using it for an entirely different purpose means that system doesn't work well. You know, like, I mean, one good example that came up the other day where people were posing as job seekers on ChatGPT and they were asking for salary advice as to what they should ask for. And the researchers were posing as a woman and a man, and the advice that came out of ChatGPT was differential as to the salary you should ask for if you're a man versus a woman. And the differences were quite stark. Kind of a medical specialist in Denver was told to ask for $400,000 a year. A female was told to ask for $280,000. Like, you know, because it's learning from information that is inherently backward-looking, information that has been generated, created and extracted in a particular way for a particular purpose, and then using it to map what our future will be, right? I wondered if you can talk a bit more about what you think about that as the one of the dehumanising elements, is what I would call it, of modern technology.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you're really pinpointing there is this. The way I describe it in the book is, you know, these machine learning models are pattern recognition machines. That's ultimately what a machine learning model is. It's a really powerful form of pattern recognition. But through that, they become pattern reinforcement machines, right? Projecting the past into future decisions. And that's all that they can do, right? Because it is how the machine actually works. It's how the system works despite what we're told. But I think The point of, like, around the politics of datafication, I think, is really important here, and it highlights how these technologies also work and why I think people are often so incensed at how they've been misrepresented or seemingly misrepresented by the technology. Because, you know, we talk about these technologies in terms of you know, these surveillance technologies, these technologies of data capture and datafication. I think on both sides, on the proponents, but also on the critical side, we talk about them at, you know, in terms of, well, they should represent me as a full integrated human subject, right? And like the system is not operating the way it should be if it does not fully represent me in the way that I see myself and in the way that I am a complex creation of lots of different characteristics and things and features and behaviors and all that kind of thing, right? And on one hand, I think this is how you get calls for the surveillance is not totalizing enough, and the way to fix the surveillance is to make it more totalizing, right? Such that it fully represents me, right? We need facial recognition that fully and equally captures people of all race and genders, right? You know, I need an insurance algorithm that fully understands every facet of my life so that I can get a more accurate and personalized, risk pricing or whatever it might be. And I think that fundamentally fails in a couple ways that fundamentally misunderstands how the politics of datafication actually works. And one hand, it fails socially because, I mean, the way to fix the system when it is, you know, has uneven outcomes is not to make it evenly operating on everybody up to the same level, right? Like, that's a socially regressive way of using socially progressive ideas to critique a system. So it fails socially, but it also fails technically. That is not how these systems work, and that is not what they are supposed to do. It is not what they can do. The fact that these systems treat us as fragmented data objects rather than integrated human subjects is a feature, not a bug, of the system, because all systems of of data capture fundamentally operate through abstraction, right? A facial recognition algorithm is not actually capturing anything, about your face that we see when we look at a person. It is capturing biometric patterns across the face and abstracting that and extracting that from the person to say, this is all that matters about the person. The thing that I as a system am able to capture is all that matters about the thing that I am capturing, because my purpose is to capture that thing, right? And so when we complain about systems not being totalizing enough, there's a social misunderstanding and a technical misunderstanding. The power of these systems comes from their abstraction. It is not a failure of the system. It is a success of the system that it is able to so powerfully abstract an individual data point or pattern or feature from somebody and say, that's all that matters about that person, right? I don't care about the human subject. I care about a vast and flowing stream of fragmented data objects. Because with those data objects, I can classify them, I can move them, I can categorize them, I can study them in ways I can't do if I have to try to worry about the whole person as a complex subject. And there's a lot of power that comes from abstracting people into data objects, and that's the point of the system.
Yeah. Like, understanding risk as a mode that is for governance, right, for ordering human relations, that is only made possible, really, by the sophisticated technologies currently at our disposal, by the systems of data collection, by the systems of data analysis. Like, it is a very compelling methodology that I don't think is really anywhere else in the world in terms of seeing the world in this way and understanding this trend and mining the seam for some rich, rich and entertaining reading is what I would say. It really knocked my socks off, because I like talking about risk because I'm a lawyer, but I just don't expect everybody does. But this is well worth your time.
It is. It goes to the what Cory Doctorow calls the shield of boringness, right? Which is that you make it's not only the kind of the work that complexity does. And this is something that finance has really benefited from, right?
Law as well, dare I say it?
Well, law as well, yeah. But, you know, you think finance and you're like, you know, collateralized debt obligations and mortgage-backed securities and, like, all these things that are designed to be extraordinarily complex. I mean, people make millions of dollars a year, not because they're, you know, doing things that nobody could possibly understand, but because they're really good at creating things so that nobody can understand them, right? But finance has a little bit of that, like, yeah, but we know it's powerful. It's Wall Street. We should try to understand how these things work, even if it's, like, pinging off my brain, right? Insurance is also, you know, benefits from that extreme complexity, but also this shield of boringness where it just it makes your eyes glaze over. But if there is like a shadow government in the world, a one world order, it is the multinational insurance industry.
But it's not just insurance, right? Risk governance comes into our lives in all sorts of ways. Like, I mean, you do go through this in, like, insurance is one aspect and it does order our lives, but risk profiling, risk governance, risk analysis for lots of decision making is imposed upon us, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is the vernacular of governance right now. We talk about things always in terms of risk, right? Anytime that you're talking about things in terms of liability, anytime that you're talking about things in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, right? Anytime you're trying to predict the likelihood of something or place a price on it, that is the language of risk, and those are the tools of risk. And they have permeated through everything, right? I think the insurance industry is its kind of beating heart and where a lot of these techniques kind of originate from, but they are now the vernacular of all governance. I mean, to the fact, and I draw this connection in the book and also in some other work, where machine learning itself is a risk technology because fundamentally machine learning is built on the same basis that actuarial science is in terms of, you know, probabilistic analysis. You take a bunch of parameters, you take a bunch of features and you throw some data into it and you run probabilistic analysis, and maybe that's your, you know, your linear algebra in terms of your like generalized linear model that actuaries use, or maybe that's your linear algebra in terms of the matrices that are the basis of machine learning. But it's fundamentally the same thing, and it's also why machine learning has become such a powerful form of risk governance, because they are fundamentally technologies of risk, even if we don't talk about them in that way. And through what Louisa Moore calls machine learning political orders, right? And so it's not just that machine learning is very powerful and very, you know, very politically powerful. Louisa Moore, the geographer and media scholar, talks about it in terms of the state starts to conceive of itself as a machine learning system. It sees the world through the eyes of the machine learning model. And by doing that, it means you're fundamentally seeing the world through the eyes of risk governance, through the eyes of probabilistic prediction, through all these things that used to just be the purview of insurance and then kind of started trickling out everywhere else and is now the purview of everything. And this idea that, right, you can't precisely understand, you can't actually predict anything in terms of, like, you can't understand precisely what's going to happen when. You can only understand things in broad strokes, like patterns in large sources of data. And that's how machine learning works. That's how actually, you know, insurance works. That's how risk governance works, is it's stochastic analysis. There's fundamental uncertainty that you cannot know when a particular risk is going to strike at any particular space-time, right? But you can know over a long period of time or over large patterns of numbers, of data, the kind of law of large numbers. You can discern patterns, right? But not precision. But the way that these technologies are sold is they're sold as technologies of precision, not technologies of probability, right? That you can understand and predict exactly when and where something is going to strike, or when and where something is going to happen. I mean, this is the fundamental promise of things like predictive policing, right? I can understand that you are going to commit a crime. I might not know exactly when you're going to do it, but I know that you're going to do it. I know where you're going to do it. And so I'm gonna attach a cop to you right now in very Minority Report, right? But that promise of precision fundamentally goes against how the technology actually works. And so this gets back to that materialist analysis of, like, you know, well, the technology is probabilistic. It only operates in large swaths of patterns over long periods of time. It does not operate in a granular or predictive fashion in any kind of precision, but there's not as much power to be gained by saying, I generally have a 70% under, you know, thing, you know, the probability distribution. You know, you go into the whole Bayesian statistics and the stuff. You know, there's not a lot of power or market share to be gained by talking in that way, right? There's a lot to be gained by saying, I know exactly when this is going to happen, or who's going to do it, or where it's going to occur, right? And that's the vernacular of the machine learning model, of personalized pricing, of all of these technologies that are fundamentally not, the claims are not just overhyped or overclaimed. They fundamentally go against the technical operations and scientific possibility of the systems that they, in the way that they actually exist. But there's a real kind of like, I reject your reality and substitute my own. And that's a lot of how these machine learning models and the kind of technopolitics of them work, is to say, yeah, there's all this stuff about probability and uncertainty and stochastic, you know, hazards and stuff. But what if I reject that and say that my technology can actually predict precisely at the address level when a flood is going to cause X number of dollars to your house, and thus I'm not going to underwrite you, right? Like, so there's that real idealist versus materialist distinction.
The book does end, not in a prescriptive way, but like an invitation to use what you've set out in the book as a tool for whatever work you might be involved in, which I think is the right way to approach this. You do talk about utopias and dystopias and how you might be able to reclaim, reject these things, or work out how to bring utopian thinking into the real world. There's a nice little quote from Oscar Wilde about this, that he says, "A map of the world that does not include utopia is not even worth glancing at," which I think is a nice framing. Like, you've got to have some idea of what's possible while also being in the real world. But do you want to tell us a bit more about that last chapter and what your call to arms is, I suppose, in terms of how you think this book can be used by people in the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the last chapter, I mean, very upfront, very at the beginning, is very self-consciously a repudiation of the common last chapter in books like this, which is the, and here's what you can do about it, or here's what you should do about it, right? I don't think that's actually helpful. I don't think anybody actually, like, puts those recipes into action or anything, right? And so I use the last chapter mainly to, set up this kind of avatar that's been in the background of much of the book, the futurist, as this kind of avatar of idealist, kind of set up a foil in the last chapter, and give a kind of brief history of futurism and this industry as a way to talk about how the tech sector, how the political economy of technological capitalism largely operates through what I call a temporal fix, kind of riffing on David Harvey's spatial fix, right? Which is this, you know, the temporal fix is a way for capital to, on one hand, construct futures as self-fulfilling prophecies through saying the classic Mark Fisher, there is no alternative capitalist realism, right? If capitalist realism operates in the kind of present tense of there is no alternative to what exists now, technological capitalism takes that and projects it infinitely into the future. And there is also, this is the only path forward. And in fact, this is the path of progress, right? We are on the trajectory of progress, and anything else would be anti-progressive or whatever it might be. And so this kind of temporal fix of creating self-fulfilling prophecies by, on one hand, talking about them in very abstract and inhuman ways, right? These things just kind of happen. They already exist out there, and we're just, it's a moving train, right? Get on board or get run over. But also the temporal fix in terms of, and you were talking about this a little bit when you were describing how in the book I talk about the kind of the death drive of capital, the way in which these systems of the insurance industry through vast personalization does fundamentally undermine its own business model, right? Through this secular crisis and bubble dynamic that venture capital and the kind of underlying dynamics of fictitious capital, so this kind of speculative, I think of it as a form of like check kiting, right? You're cashing a check today and promising that the funds are going to be in the account at some indeterminate time in the future. That kind of temporal fix of always kicking the can down the road, right? Never paying the bill, never hoping anyone calls your bluff. And that is what the whole industry of the tech sector is really built on right now, which is, it's built on sandcastles in the sky, speculative value, fictitious capital, kicking the can down the road. So talk about it in terms of, what in sociology we can think of as the Tinkerbell effect, right? That like, Tinkerbell and Peter Pan only exist if you believe hard enough and clap loud enough for her, right? And if you stop believing in her and stop clapping for her, she starts fading away, right? Transparency level keeps increasing. It's like, Peter, clap for me, believe in me, right? And that's how the tech sector operates right now. It's like, there's so many examples. I mean, it's like, the metaverse, never heard of it, right? Web3, wrong number. Google Glass, can't even, And there's so many examples of things where people were telling us this is inevitable, this is the future, we're going to invest billions of dollars into making it happen. And people have just decided, no, not today. And then it just kind of goes away, right? So like this idea that these things are inevitable, that you can't reject them, that they are kind of immutable features of our life, it's undermined by the fact that we are surrounded by a graveyard of failed inventions, false gods, right? But we're also told to forget about them, or we're told to think about them in different ways, like how, you know, Luddite has become a derogatory term, completely disconnected from the real history of labor radicalism. We're in Trades Hall, after all. That was the basis of the Luddite movement, right? And so I think that that temporal fix, and in the last chapter of the book, it really is about understanding how this political economy of the future is also a weak point of the system of technological capitalism, because it is, while we are engaging in a materialist analysis, they are building systems on immaterial promises. And understanding the immaterialism at their foundation understands also that there's no there there, and all we have to do is reject it.
Awkward first question. Jathan, you know, long-time listener, first-time caller. So my question is around sort of, I guess, what you were just talking about in terms of the final chapter, and you're not going to give prescriptions, but I want to push you and the panel to talk about maybe avenues around collective refusal and sabotage, a la the Luddites. Super quick. I work in a public library. My day job is helping people with technology. It fucking sucks, man. I'm a political Luddite and I'm forced to be an idealist. And I'm helping people deal with the graveyard of technology, and often the people who are most marginalised in our society deal with the shit world that is having to use technology for fucking everything. Like, refusal is not possible on an individual level. Like, it's... I feel like it does my head in sometimes. So, like, obviously it's got to be collective. So where do you see as avenues for collective refusal and collective sabotage, given that we can't just refuse to use this? Well, good luck to people who do manage to refuse to use these technologies.
A really excellent first question, and thank you for breaking the ice. Yes, very, very good. Really appreciate that. And I think it is really important, and you're exactly right. I mean, none of this is individualistic, right? I think that there is a strain of this kind of refusenik, you know, approach that is like, I don't know, man, just have like a digital detox and, you know, like log off on Sundays or something. I mean, sure, if that makes your life better, don't, you know, I don't use a lot of software because I don't want to, right? But like, I know that that's not like causing the change in the world that I want to see, because these things are, they're fundamentally collective, but they're also fundamentally intersectional, right? And I think that that's really important, is that there's only so much ground you can cover and only so much momentum you can build by saying, I'm over here doing my thing. I'm doing my Luddite thing over here, and, you know, like, we're trying to, you know, tear down Google one, you know, X post at a time, right? Like, there's only so much you can do with that, because if it becomes disconnected from what I think are fundamentally connected struggles, where, you know, we heard Lucy give a really nice and impassioned plea for solidarity with people in Gaza, right? And I think that that's extraordinarily important to see that these things are connected, right? Because there is a military industrial complex, which right now is, you know, fundamentally a military Silicon Valley complex. You know, this is the heart of Silicon Valley, is rediscovering its roots in military contracting. And, you know, the basis of, you know, I think about Antony Lowenstein's great book, The Palestine Laboratory, right? Talking about, these are test beds for technologies that are sold as battle-tested around the world, tactics that are sold as battle-tested around the world. And, you know, these things are not disconnected. The labor struggle is not disconnected from a struggle about technology. Social progressive, social justice struggles, right? Trans rights, gay rights, these are not disconnected from struggles of technology, right? But also, it's not to say we have to reframe these things in a kind of colonizing way of like, actually, these are all struggles about technology. My framing is the correct one, right? It's about saying that we're all working in different ways on our different very important projects, but what if we all worked together on the one big project, right? Because if there's one thing that capital does really well, is it sees the world as the playground of capital C, right? That like there are different strains of capital, but they all operate in the same system. Even within a competitive market, there is the silent collusion of market logics, right? It is what Marx, and then in a really excellent book called Mute Compulsion by Soren Mao, talks about the kind of the economic power of capital as a fundamental and even more powerful third type outside of the kind of violent coercive power of capital, go to work or else, you know, you got a gun to your head, or the ideological power of capital, go to work because hustling and grinding is actually really good for you, versus the mute compulsion of economic power, go to work or don't. I mean, it's up to you if you want to eat tonight, you know, like, and that's a more powerful way. And so that's how capital orchestrates a system of oppression, of exploitation, is through the mute compulsion of working together, even in a competitive market. And I think, you know, it's the against the sectarianism of leftism, I think it's understanding that there are strains that we have to connect all these things together, so that, you know, we should understand libraries. And, you know, I have many dear friends who are librarians and work in information schools and in library science, and they understand the library as a radical institution, right? And an institution for fundamentally radical change, and an institution that, despite the best, you know, despite what capital wants, right? The libraries also operate as places as kind of like, you know, on the fringes of market logics, right? It's one of the few places a truly public library, you know, has to operate within a market society, but also can operate kind of outside the market society. We don't have a lot of those institutions left. And I think those are the places as well that become real important sites of radical intersectional collective action, where we see that the critique of technology is also the critique of genocide, it's also the critique of transphobia, is also, you know, also all these things are actually the same thing. And I think there's a lot of power and untapped power still left in understanding that.
Hi. I was at Open Day with my daughter on Sunday. There was an AI seminar with like dean of or head of students, executives from like Microsoft and Adobe, and I asked a question of, are we just teaching students to cut and paste with language models, or are they actually, how do they engage with learning? How do you think in the academy you can push back and support students to not use the technology and help your fellow academics to push back against? Because I know they're so horny for pushing this on everybody.
Yeah, it's a really important point. I will say, so I'm in the Faculty of Information Technology at Monash, right? It's the only faculty of IT in the group of eight prestigious universities in Australia. It's one of the top faculties of IT in the world. And we are every day having active and critical conversations about how shitty ChatGPT is and how much generative AI is ruining academic research and education, right? And so it's like, you know, in the faculty of IT, where you would expect, and there are surely people who are like, you know, I love it, or I'm so dependent on it that it doesn't matter if I love it because I need it. There are surely people like that, but there are also a lot of people across the faculty, a place that you would think would be a bastion of idealist enthusiasm for this, where people are like, these systems are not good, and they are the products of imperatives at the institutional level of the university and among the corporations building them that are actively counter to the things that we see as good academic research and education, right? And so that is to say is that, yeah, I think the teachers are on board, but I think the fundamental problem here is it goes back to, I mean, surprise, surprise, right? It's the capitalism. Yeah? It's the fact that, like, universities are run as hedge funds that sometimes teach classes, you know? It is the fact that depend only on massive for-profit corporations to build these models and institute them is the fact that Monash, for example, we have a learning analytics, a lab for learning analytics in the Monash Faculty of IT. And I'm friends and I work with a lot of people in that lab, and they're doing a lot of very interesting and very critical stuff around creating education technologies that actually enable and support the process of learning, you know, doing really innovative work. Monash does not use the products that are created by their own world-class, world-leading academics. They use the products created by Microsoft, right? And that is, it tells you who's the university serving, who do you work for, right? And it's not the academics, and it's not the students, right? They work for investors, they work for ranking organizations that create these global rankings, right? They work for other things that are not what we think of as the service of the university. But the problem comes when people say, that really sucks and there's nothing I can do about it, despite me being a professor this or that or a student, right? The problem comes when you just kind of lay down and take it and say, well, you know, that's what the vice provost says or whatever, right? Or that's what the chancellor says. And we're at this point with generative AI across the university, but across all institutions, where things are not set yet. Norms are becoming norms, and standards are becoming standards. They have not become norms, and they have not become standards. They are still in the process of becoming, right? And that is a moment which rejection and critique and change can happen before they become so ossified in the operation of the institution that it's unimaginable to have an institution without them. At that point, you are kind of too late. You just have to burn the whole thing down, right? But we're not at that point yet. Despite what people who are proponents of AI tell us, which is that we are long past that point. You can't imagine running an institution without AI. But we know from the empirical research that AI only works in these institutions thanks to a lot of people doing a lot of work to fill in the gaps and clean up the messes from the AI system. They only work because people are saying, this is what you have to do, even if it means you have to redo the work that the AI does, because you have to make the AI work, right? And so then it becomes, who is the system working for me, or am I working for the system, right? We're at that point where norms are becoming norms and standards are becoming standards. And I think the grumbling among, you know, academics, I also know students who are, they know that they're not learning, right? But they feel like they have no choice because they don't want to get left behind. They also see everyone else doing it. They also are told this is what you have to do, right? And it's a path of least resistance. And I think rather than doing as well what capital is really good at doing, I talk about this in the book, which is creating antagonisms between people who should not be antagonistic so that capital can say, yes, fight amongst yourself and I will do my thing over here, right? And I think it is creating unnecessary antagonisms between academics and students as if that's the battle that should be fought, when in reality the antagonisms should be both of them saying, why are you, the university, investing tons of sunk cost into buying universal licenses for this technology? Why are you, OpenAI or whoever, you know, actively selling this technology as a form of, like, cheating as a service or whatever, right? Like, the antagonism should be not me versus the students, but it should be us versus the institution, us versus these ideologies. And I think we will fail until we understand where those antagonistic forces should actually be directed.
Over here. Hi. Thank you very much for the talk, and thanks for the beer as well. Two kind of questions, one more general and one a little more specific. So I missed the terminology a bit. I can't remember whether it's structures or systems, but you describe technology and capitalism as two kind of interacting systems. And in one sense, capitalism is kind of defined by its structure. As you said, you can have variations of a theme of capitalism, but it is what it is. Capital is capital. Whereas technology isn't so inherently defined. So I'm just wondering, for your purposes here, I really love the argument, but in terms of how you define, is this just capitalism and capitalist technology, or what lines do you draw to define technology as a system, because it isn't inherently something in the same way capitalism is? And then maybe a little more specifically, and you really touched this at the end of your talk, which I really enjoyed, is there seems to be, although there are very notable exceptions, such as the military and risk assessment, things like that, there's a very speculative nature to AI development and tons of money going in, but an inability to kind of for it to generate profit in the same way, in terms of, I'm just speaking specifically about AI, or at least in terms of some people talking about this. So that seems like an antagonism there between what technology is generating materially on one hand, and I what it's purporting or what it's putting its money into. Obviously, there's lots of money around it, but in terms of what it's generating for profit there. And you talked a lot about it at the end, I think, in the same area, but I'd love to hear a little more on that as well. But thanks again.
So two questions there. So on one hand, the question of technology does not have any kind of, does not inherently have a logic or a politics to it. And then the question of the kind of, where is the, where are the profits of AI coming from, and how do we kind of distinguish between those claims and all the money and investment, if I'm understanding correctly, and like where is it actually coming from? So on one hand, the question of technology, I think is right. I mean, there is nothing inherent in technology, but it is also the fact that like technologies are not neutral, right? Like technologies are, they have politics embedded in them, values designed into them. And there's, the third chapter of the book is on innovation, which is actually a chapter about the political economy of venture capital and how that influences and overdetermines the technological ecosystem. And in the, I think maybe the first chapter or the first section of that chapter, or maybe the second section, is called the silent modifier, right? And what I mean by that is capitalist is the silent modifier. So when we talk about innovation, when we talk about technology, it's almost always in white ink, capitalist innovation, capitalist technology, right? And what I mean by that as well is that it is forms of, it's ways of conceiving of what innovation are, right? Conceiving of innovation as things that can be, for example, scaled rapidly, can absorb a lot of capital and have the potential to return massive, 10x investment. That is what we conceive of as innovation. It's why software eats the world. Not because there's something inherent in software where software is more innovative than other forms of deep tech or hard tech, right? It's that software is more conducive to scaling extremely fast and lean and absorbing a lot of capital and potentially returning 10 or 100x to a venture capitalist, right? And so that's why all innovation is software, right? It's because there's a kind of silent modifier determining what that is, and through that you get baked into it a lot of politics and a lot of values and a lot of motivations and goals of what that means. So of course, there are lots of ways to conceive of what technology can and should be. And, I talk about it in the book a little bit more. I talk about, and lots of people have written about, like, how do we conceive of what, like, what we might think of as, like, red innovation, right? Or a very, a leftist or socialist or communist form of technology or innovation, right? Well, it also means conceiving of it as somehow exists, as something that exists outside the very narrow constraints and parameters and conditions of a form of a system of venture capital, right? Like, if you're trying to build, socialist technology in a system of venture capital, you're Sisyphus pushing a boulder up the hill. You might get up the hill if you push really hard with a lot of people, but it's still going to be a hamstrung piece of technology because it was fundamentally built in a system that is anti all of those values. So you're building the technology despite the system, not because of the system. So what we need is a system to actually build the things that we want to build, right? Forms of governance and support and funding and financing and envisioning and all of that, right? And so that's what I mean when I talk about technology and talk about the politics of technology. Again, it's that materialist understanding of the conditions that give rise to technology give rise to specific kinds of technology in specific ways for specific reasons. And if we get something else out of that, it's on accident, not because that was the purpose of the system or the technology, right? And in terms of where is, you know, the AI industry getting its profits if it's not from, you know, AI is hemorrhaging money. AI is propped up. Not only is AI propped up by trillions of dollars of venture capital investment right now, the U.S. economy is propped up by it. There was a report in the Wall Street Journal showing that the investment into AI infrastructure, so capital expenditure into AI, outpaced the consumer spending index for the U.S. economy. So despite the fact that the U.S. should be in a deep, deep economic depression or at least recession because of Trump's tariffs, because of stagnant and lowering wages, because of all these, despite that, in the GDP numbers, it looks like the economy is growing slowly. That growth has come from trillions of dollars of investment from a handful of tech companies into AI, right? And so that's incredible to even try to comprehend, that the forces of capital have come together to say, we will make it appear as if Trump's economic policies are not actually throwing the US into a deep economic recession. That's incredible. And in return, the US government is propping up the AI industry. AI is not making money from consumer products. AI is not making money from the release of GPT-5 or whatever it is, despite the incredible user statistics of these LLMs. AI is making money through massive government contracts from the military and other agencies and from the fossil fuel industry, right? That is where AI is making money from, right? And so it's both hands are washing each other, right? AI industry will prop up the U.S. economy in terms of GDP stats, and in return, the U.S. government will prop up the AI industry. Two best friends going at it together while the rest of us are down here being like, hey, is there anything for me? You know, that's the AI industry. That's where profits are coming from right now. And eventually, that dries up, right? Like, it dries up because you can't continue to cash a check when your account balance is in the negative billions. At some point, right, the Federal Reserve or somebody says enough is enough. And it's also why Trump wants to fire Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, right? And so at some point, the check comes due. The question is when and who has to deal with the aftermath of a drunk bender with a $1 trillion tab.
I mean, I know no one really wants to hear me answer these questions, but I would just put a quick pitch in for, in terms of defining technology, for Ursula Le Guin's essay about this, where she talks about the carrier bag theory of fiction, because she's often associated as not being a science fiction writer because, as she describes it, she doesn't have, you know, fancy machines, things that bash and kill people in that is considered sophisticated forms of technology. And instead, she argues that the carrier bag, which collected nuts, berries, whatever, for thousands of years supplied 85% of humans' diet of their calorific needs, is an innovation that is vastly important and ignored in the definition of technology. So, like, I do think there's a definition of, she defines technology, I've got it here somewhere, I think she describes it as the active human interface with the material world, which I think is an interesting definition. Like, what would it mean to have a more expansive definition of technology that isn't framed around profit, that isn't framed around domination of the physical world, management of people that you perceive as a threat to your dominance? Like, this is the kind of way in which I think we should start thinking about technology as a project of human emancipation rather than a project of profit.
The ideological output of AI visuals, as in like the text-to-image generative AI, because I've been thinking about scholars in the visual sphere like Walter Benjamin and about how they talk about fascism as the aestheticization of politics and how I've been seeing that in generative AI visuals and how that might relate to...
So Walter Benjamin, of course, but I also think of like John Berger's ways of seeing, right? And so we can think about, again, what is generative AI? It's a pattern recognition machine, but it's also a pattern reinforcement machine. It's giving you what is already in the corpus of data and overrepresented in that corpus, right? And we can think about as well John Berger's, you know, excellent, you know, docuseries and the book, you know, Ways of Seeing, in terms of thinking about why was it that all of these paintings by the Dutch masters were about, like, you know, still lifes of luxury and portraits of wealthy people? Is that because that's what everyday life in the Netherlands looked like in the 15th century or whatever? Or is that because the only people who were wealthy enough to be patrons of the arts were people who were like, paint me like, you know, one of your French girls or something like that, right? And so that becomes overrepresented, right? And similarly, you know, the DALL-E and these technologies, and you'll pull so much from, you know, they pull from the internet, right? And what is the internet filled with, especially if you are training your models on sites like Reddit, right? What is Reddit filled with, right? It's filled with, you know, fringe right, alt right, you know, Pepe meme frogs, and like, you know, Roman statue avatar havers, you know. But again, like, that's the corpus of data that it's pulling from, and so it is a almost, you know, once as tragedy, you know, then as farce kind of idea of like, you know, well, you know, the tragedy is the overrepresentation of wealth in the, you know, in the oil paintings of the Dutch masters. The farce is the overrepresentation of Pepe memes in the, you know, in the data set of DALL-E, right? And so it's like no surprise that we're going to have a weirdly smooth techno-fascist aesthetic when it is pulling those images from the weirdly smooth brains of fascists on Reddit, right? And so, that, like, again, it's the pattern becomes the thing that's reinforced.